Alaskans know that healthcare costs here are more expensive than outside, but beyond distance, what else contributes to those rates? Why is it cheaper to fly to Seattle for some procedures than have them done here? I'm Lori Townsend, and today we'll be discussing how it is that Alaska has healthcare costs that are among the highest in the world. And those costs are increasing at an unsustainable rate. What's known about those big numbers, and what can be done to help lower them? We've got the experts in the studio to help us understand the cost of healthcare on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence at fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend sitting in for Steve Heimel. And today we're going to discuss the cost of healthcare in Alaska and try to get a little better understanding of why it's higher than in other places, considerably higher in some specialty care areas. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call if you'd like to let us know what your experience has been with healthcare costs in Alaska. 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. Or you can email us talk@aprn.org. Joining me in the studio is Deb Erickson. She is the executive director of Alaska's Healthcare Commission. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And also Jeffrey Davis. He's the president of Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska and also a member of the Alaska Healthcare Commission. Hi.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for being here in the studio with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get right into the meat of this. Deb, how much does healthcare cost in Alaska compared to other states?
Well, one of the things the commission did this past year, the commission, first of all, was established in 2010, just a little over a year ago, by the Alaska legislature, and we're charged with coming up with some policy recommendations for the governor and the legislature related to improving accessibility and affordability and quality of health care in the state. And so this past year, we spent some time studying overall health care spending in the state, as well as prices for some specific services. And we learned through one of those studies, which was conducted by the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, that total healthcare spending in the state last year during 2010 grew to $7.5 billion. It was a 40% increase since the last time they had done a similar study, which had been just 5 years before. And they projected that total healthcare spending in the state will double again by the year 2020. And if you do the math, it works out to roughly $10,000 per person in the state of Alaska for every man, woman, and child. And the commission's concern is that the healthcare services and our healthcare industry is a vital industry and very important service for us to have available in our communities. And the affordability of those services for the individuals and for employers is critically important, and the sustainability of those services is critically important.
Mm-hmm.
And Alaska, you asked about the comparison. Alaska, if you look at total spending for all health care and health services, Alaska ranks number one in the nation. If you look at expenditures for personal health services specifically, we rank second in the nation behind Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, I think just one of the things we need to understand, we're just slightly less, $150 per person less. But Massachusetts, almost everybody is covered. I think they have about a 2% uninsurance rate, where ours is, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 15 and 20%.
So Massachusetts has a state-run health...
They have implemented a statewide health reform plan.
Okay, that's somewhat similar to the federal legislation.
It's similar in some ways to the federal, mm-hmm.
but yet their costs are higher than in Alaska.
That would be correct. Total spending per person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. And maybe we can talk a little more about mm-hmm. that. But let's talk a bit about the Healthcare Commission. It just released a series of reports. What were some of the questions that you were trying to answer in these reports about the costs in Alaska?
Well, one of the things that the group had talked about kind of as the elephant in the room was how prices varied in Alaska compared to other states. And so we commissioned a study by a healthcare actuarial firm named Milliman to take the two categories of service that we spend the most money on, which is hospital services and physician services, roughly 30% for each of those, so about more than half, 60% of all spending for healthcare is for those two categories of service. And we picked those two and compared to some other states in the Pacific Northwest and also a couple of more rural states that we selected to try to get a handle on and to publicly document for the first time, too, because, well, there was a lot of discussion in the back room and about if our prices are higher, to what extent they're higher, and why there was really no public information. So we thought it was important to support starting the conversation, have some public information about those prices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to really try to separate fact from fiction. And we didn't, as Deb said, that was not available before. And so we tried to help working with Milliman to structure a study in a way that it did that. And you have to look at a fairly granular level to try to really understand where the issues are, because the last thing we wanted to do was go down a path that wasn't supported by reality. Well, it was a very valuable study in that.
And so, in general, what does drive up the cost? I mean, I think people can speculate on some of them, distance and that sort of thing, but what else contributes?
Yeah, there's not one answer, and there's lots of things, and they don't always apply, and sometimes they do. It is distance. I mean, as Alaskans, we expect things are going to cost more, and there's good reasons for that. You know, why are groceries more expensive? Well, there's a lot of things that go into that. Why is a can of paint more expensive? Things that go into that. It's the same. Part of the answer is it's the same with healthcare. A great example was given by Mr. Pat Branko, who's the administrator and CEO of Ketchikan General Hospital and also on the commission. And he shared with us, he said, in Ketchikan, all the physicians are employed by the hospital. And he said, I only need 1.25 orthopedic surgeons. But living on an island, I can't have 1.25 orthopedic surgeons. I have to have 2. And I thought that was just a great example of what happens in the rural communities. And then, you know, the inputs are more, you know, the cost of living is more, salaries more, all of those things happen, you know, statewide. And then there's also a phenomenon that we think we observed in the study is there's just market power is part of it. There are instances where there's maybe 1 or 2 of a particular kind of provider, and then when you have that sort of a situation, you tend to have prices that are higher as well. So it's a variety of factors, and I think you can't really generalize, but you can at least start to look and see where there are perhaps some things that, you know, look out of whack. I thought one thing that was interesting is in the primary care services, primary care specialties, family practice, pediatrics, those sorts of things, they were pretty much where you would expect to find them falling out because you're in Alaska. And in across those, there are greater numbers of providers, too. So that would be something that you would expect to see. Mm-hmm. It was interesting.
1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the number if you'd like to join our conversation statewide. Or if you're in the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@aprn.org. We do have a caller, and we'll get to that in just a minute, but let's talk a little bit about that specialty care and how that's very expensive in Alaska. Deb, what did the report find in that regard?
Well, we looked at a number of specialties, including primary care specialties, as Jeff was just referencing. And one of the interesting findings from the study was the variation in the in the differences between spending in Alaska compared to the other states for the different specialties. And as Jeff mentioned, for the primary care specialties, pediatricians, family practitioners, we in Alaska pay roughly 40% more than the average of all of the what's paid in all of these other states that we compare to. But for other specialties, such as cardiology or orthopedic surgeons, it's more like 80% more.
Jeff, you're in the insurance business, and do insurance companies ever come together and say, how can we help with bring some of these costs down? Or maybe this is the wrong way to look at this, but mm-hmm. let me ask this question. You mentioned Ketchikan only needing 1.25 specialists in is there ever a thought of either hospitals coming together or insurance companies and saying, let's get someone that's sort of a rotating surgeon mm-hmm. that can go to different communities to kind of fill that quarter need that's there? Or does that not work in cases where there's emergencies happening and you can't kind of schedule that sort of thing?
Well, there to your specific question, there are some specialties where there are people who travel around and not so much driven by the collective action of carriers. There aren't a lot of other carriers who have enough mass here that they'd be interested. But what I think also in your question is, you know, what do we do about it? Let's level set just a little bit. The cost of health insurance is directly related to the cost of health care. So as health care goes up, so does health care insurance prices. We live on a profit margin of 1-2%, which would surprise a lot of people. But that's fairly typical for a nonprofit health insurance company like us. And that 1-2% gets put back into the company for reserves to take care of the future health care needs of our members for the next swine flu epidemic or whatever it might be, or an economic downturn. There's about 8% that gets spent on average for administration. So for everything we do, it's about 8%. And there's about 2% state taxes and 2% that goes to commission. So about 15 cents on the dollar that's collected goes to pay for other things. So 85 cents on the dollar goes to pay for health care. So as health care goes up, and you heard the numbers Deb gave earlier from the ICER report, you think about $10,000 per year per person, and then trying to cover with a health insurance policy, that means that's going to be $10,000 plus the admin, plus the margin, et cetera, to go into that. And it gets to be pretty scary numbers. Mm-hmm. So what I've observed and been in Alaska since 1997 and been in healthcare since, I hate to say it, 1982, so I've been around the block a few times, is that costs have always been an issue. They have always been. But the severity or the pain that's being felt now, particularly in Alaska, given the numbers that Deb gave you, is different. Last 18 months, 2 years, clients are really saying, we just can't do this, and therefore are willing to look at options that they wouldn't look at before. And when I started here, it was axiomatic that benefit plans were richer here and the co-pays were lower compared to the lower 48. It was like there was just so much money and people were competing with some big employers who had very rich benefits, that's the way it was, and dependents were covered. Well, that has just changed dramatically.
And that was in 97?
That was in 97,
wow.
Yeah. And that's changed dramatically, particularly in the last few years. So now we have this situation where deductibles are higher and fewer dependents are covered and benefits aren't as rich. And kind of employers, I think, are feeling like they've run the course of that. So now they're willing to look at other things that would not be considered before. Look at, do we actively try to encourage people to go outside for certain kinds of care? That just wasn't even on the radar. And, of course, that has some implications for long-run sustainability here. So what we're trying to do is, and I can only speak for us, is try to find that road in the middle where we have a sustainable system. It has to be sustainable from a cost standpoint, but also from a supply standpoint. You know, we all as Alaskans want to have someone there when we end up or our loved one ends up in the ER. So we have to make sure we do that, but at the same time, figure out ways that we can make this affordable for the people who are paying the bills. And that's what I spend most of my time working on.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call if you're outside of Anchorage. 550 8422 is the number to call if you're in the Anchorage area. We're going to take a call right now from Bill in Anchorage, who has a question about insurance regulations. Bill, I can't see all of the text here, so why don't you
I see a naturopath, okay, and a naturopath is a medical doctor with another year of, you know, body mechanics, herbs, and that kind of thing. There's a law in the state of Alaska that was passed in, I don't know, 96 or something, saying that naturopaths and chiropractors will be paid the same as MDs. So a naturopath is designated as an ND, not an MD. Point is, I have insurance. I go to see my ND. They say, no, you have to go to an MD first for us and get referred to an ND to get paid. So when I hear this thing about selling insurance across state lines, saying, you know, if you can buy it cheaper in Ohio if you live in Pennsylvania, there's a loophole here, and there's a state law. And being a cancer survivor kind of thing, I like to stay healthy by seeing my naturopathic doctor because he works with the body systems. And I was just curious what you would say about all that.
So your question is that you're confused about what the insurance regulations dictate as to when you can see your naturopath?
Basically, I'm confused that if we have a law in the state of Alaska that says naturopathic doctors will be paid, but my insurance company is based in New York, they say we don't have to pay in Alaska your naturopathic charges, and we're not going to pay your naturopathic charges because we're based in New York. So they're not following the state law because there's this loophole that the insurance company is based in another state.
Jeff, if you want to take a crack at that, but my first thought was maybe it's time he calls the insurance commissioner.
Well, the Division of Insurance, certainly, Bill, could give you some good insight into that, but I'll try. You are correct that there is Alaska, I don't know if it's statute or regulation, that requires the same, that you treat different provider types the same if they're providing the same service under their, and it's within the scope of their licensure. So whether it's from an advanced nurse practitioner or a naturopath or an MD, anyone providing that same service, you can't discriminate against the way, you don't, they might not charge the same, but you have to treat, if you're paying 80% for the MD, you have to pay 80% for the naturopath, et cetera, et cetera. So the provision that you talk about in your plan, which requires a referral, must be, I'm guessing, is a particular requirement of that plan that you're on. I don't believe there's anything in Alaska law that I'm aware of that would either require a referral or say you couldn't do that, but it would be a function, I'm guessing it's a function of the plan. But any carrier who is selling coverage in Alaska has to follow Alaska regulations. But if your plan is being purchased by a firm who's in New York and you just happen to be an employee of that New York firm, I believe that New York law would apply to you and not Alaska law. But I'm not 100% certain, but I do know the Division of Insurance would be certain.
And Bill,
to make it even more complicated, the company I work for, I'm retired from, is based out of Memphis, but they buy insurance out of New York.
So the company...
My main point is this, okay, there's a law. I'm trying to stay healthy by seeing a naturopath, and I can't go and afford to see this guy because of the insurance law, okay? And people aren't really aware of this. And it's a thing when people talk about, you know, competitive pricing for insurance, the first thing they mention is buying insurance across state lines, okay?
Right.
If this happens, the people buy insurance in Alaska and say, see how we get it cheaper, and they don't pay, insurance is not going to be, it's not a viable option.
So, Bill, I have a question just for you, so just so that I'm clear about this. The company that you worked for is based in New York, or the insurance company that you're buying insurance from?
The company that I work for is based in Memphis.
Okay, in Memphis.
They bought insurance through a New York based
Okay, firm. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, and you've given us some more things to think about. We're going to go to Matt in Sitka now, who has a statement about Alaska's small population. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
We have a state that's what, roughly a third the size of the continental United States, or maybe a little smaller than that, with a population of only 700,000 or so people, and a number of, quite a few of those people, maybe a third, a quarter, are Alaska Natives who are covered by the federal government. that leaves a population of some 500,000 people or less to pay for the health care here in Alaska. And many of us, myself included, are not insured. I'm self-employed. I can't afford health insurance anymore. I haven't been able to afford it for some years, and now I'm older. Here in my community in Sitka, we have two hospitals in the same, it's a microcosm of the state. You know, the population is about 8,500 people, 8,000 people, and we have two hospitals. So it's amazing to me that we have any health care at all. I don't know how it can ever be affordable in Alaska. We're basically the size of a moderate city in the United States population-wise with an area that's so massive. It's amazing to me that we have as much health care as we do. It's certainly not affordable, and I don't know if it'll ever be affordable.
An excellent point. Thanks for the call, Matt. We're going to take another call, and then I think we'll read a couple of emails, too. We're getting lots of response today on Talk of Alaska, talking about health care. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. And we're going to Iris now in Juneau, who has a question about what is usual and customary. Hi, Iris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, you know, I submit a claim, and then I get a statement back saying what my insurance company is going to pay, and quite often there's a little caveat that says that this is above customary and usual, and I would kind of like to know what this is based on the fact that it was just said that insurance and your premiums are based on what medical costs are. So I would assume that what customary and usual here would not be customary and usual, say, in Washington State. But what is that based on when that's looked at?
Jeff, would you like to take a crack at that?
I would be happy to. Great question, Iris. An area of lots of confusion. So let's just kind of step back and say, why would we? There are regulations around this, which I will get to. But why would you even have a provision like this of usual, customary, and reasonable? It's an old term, but what it means is, you know, what's normal in that community and what's reasonable. Okay, so if you have an insurance policy, it's a promise to pay, if you will, and so you go to a physician and they do a service that should be $1,000. Okay, so the company pays that $1,000. What if you went to a physician who decided they were going to retire next week, so they're just going to charge everyone $1 million? That would clearly not be a reasonable solution. So how do you find reasonable in the middle? Well, Alaska law says that usual, customary, and reasonable, and this is for companies who are doing business here and regulated here, must be based on the market cost in that geography in Alaska. And it must be at least the 80th percentile. So now we're wading into real dangerous territory. We start getting into math here. But the 80th percentile is the point, if you had 100 charges, the 80th percentile would be the point, if you graph them all out from lowest to highest, the 80th percentile would be the point at which 80 charges were less than that particular one and 20 were more. So if you had 100 physicians all charging something different, 80 times out of 100, the UCR would be set at that point where it was above what everyone else, what the 80 were charging, okay? So 80th percentile is the rule that applies. And companies are required to determine what that would be for this market and for those locales. So I don't know who your carrier is, obviously, but different carriers take different approaches. We have enough membership in Alaska that we use our own data every 6 months to go through every single CPT-4 code, so every single procedural code, and determine what the 80th percentile is for that code in that geography. We divide Alaska into four different geographies.
Every 6 months.
We're required to review it every 6 months.
Okay.
Other carriers who don't have as much business and so their data is not credible will buy this service from another organization. There's one I think is called Fair Health now, is probably the most widely used. And so your carrier is probably using one of those methods. And if your physician's charging at or below the 80th percentile, there's no what we call balance bill. And if they're charging more than that, then there's likely to be a balance bill. We Premier Blue Cross actually use the 90th percentile in Alaska, and it's very close to the 80th percentile.
Oh, well, thank you very much, because I was hoping it wasn't based on what I would have been charged in Seattle.
it shouldn't be, and that's the reason it's that regulation exists, is so that you are protected.
Yeah.
Well,
what if you're limited? I won't take too much time, but I live in Juneau. We have one hospital, and these are fees that I was charged from this hospital, and there's no other option for someone to go to or to shop around to make sure that you're within that 80th percentile. Is that I'm just stuck?
the way we've addressed that is we divide the state into four regions. Ketchikan's its own region. Southeast is another region. Anchorage, Fairbanks is the third, and then Anchorage and the rest of the state is the fourth. And so we've done that to hopefully, when you're in Juneau, and we're, at least when we're developing UCR, it's based on what's being charged in that region. But yeah, there are circumstances where there's no choice, and that's just part of our geography.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Iris. Excuse me. 1-800-478-8255 is the number outside of the Anchorage area, 550-8422. In the studio with me today is Deb Erickson, who is the Executive Director of Alaska's Healthcare Commission, and Jeffrey Davis, who is the President of Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska and also a member of the Healthcare Commission. We're going to go to an email now. This is from... Let's see, her name is Frances in Anchorage. She says that a neurologist recently tested her for a possible nerve condition, and three codes were used. She said in each case she's charging me 10 times the local going rate. And she said by the local going rate, I mean at the 95 percentile. I spent less than 1 hour with her. The total charge is $16,900. Other medical providers have been shocked by these charges. Her question is, what would you do about these charges if you were in my shoes? And do I have any pushback rights at all? Who wants to take that?
Well, Deb and I are pointing to each other here. I will try. The other thing that we know looking at charges here is that there's a significant variability. So you can be within a specialty with looking at a code, and you can determine where the 80th or the 90th percentile is, and then find someone who's charging double that is not unusual to find. And what the situation that we have now is that there's a floor, but there is no ceiling. And there are conversations taking place, I think directly because of the Milliman study that highlighted this, to say, wow, this may be an area where the Alaska regulation that was put in place as a consumer protection now we've found an unintended consequence. So don't know where that will go for sure, but the intent would be to help with situations like the one Frances ran into. In her particular case now, I don't know of any, real legal recourse, but what we advise people to do is to go back, show the data that you have to the provider who's billing you, and see if that provider will come to a different conclusion about what should be charged.
Yeah, I would echo what Jeff said. I would encourage Frances to go back to that provider and ask some questions. But I think one of the things that the commission has focused all of our strategies, we haven't really talked much about solutions yet, but we're focusing all of our conversation about solutions around what can we do to empower consumers and patients in their role in both maintaining their own health, but also in the receipt of their healthcare services. And so one of the areas we've been studying for solutions is around transparency in price and quality of healthcare services. And I think one of the things I would encourage all consumers to do now, we don't have a state policy about this, but I think I'm imagining the commission will come out with a more specific recommendation next year. This year we're looking at some methodologies, data collection methodologies, specifically for supporting price and quality transparency. But we will, I would encourage any patient to feel free to ask their provider questions before any sort of procedure, both about the price that they'll be charged and what services they can expect to receive. I think there's people have been shy for a variety of reasons about doing that in the past and need to be less shy right. about engaging in that sort of conversation with their provider.
That's an interesting point, I think, because no one has any qualms about going to a car dealer and kind of haggling over the price of a car. But I think people are somewhat intimidated by the whole medical structure. And so when you go, you just listen. You don't ask questions often.
And I believe that is changing. And I would just add to what Deb said. So find out from the provider what the codes are and what they're going to charge, and then call your carrier and say, now, what will you pay for this? And then have the conversation beforehand. It's a lot different conversation than afterwards.
We're talking about the cost of healthcare in Alaska today on Talk of Alaska. And we've got Deb Erickson, the Executive Director of Alaska's Healthcare Commission, in the studio. Jeffrey Davis, who's the President of Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska and a member of the commission. And we're going to be talking with Don Rush. We'll hear from a rural healthcare provider who is the administrator of the Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center when Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us on Talk of Alaska today. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for Steve Heimel. We're talking about healthcare costs in Alaska. And we're going to go now to the phone and talk with Don Rush, who is the administrator of the Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center. Hi, Don.
Hi.
So healthcare costs are higher in rural Alaska. Don, what are the biggest factors that drive up costs in Kodiak?
Well, you know, I was listening to your discussion a little earlier on in the program, and they talked about the Milliman Report and the cost drivers. And, you know, when I moved to Alaska, I'll just share this with you, when I moved to Alaska about 10 years ago from Montana, similar-sized hospital, I was sort of immediately shell-shocked, I guess, by the cost of health care in Alaska and even on Kodiak Island. I just couldn't quite make the connection until I sort of got acclimated to the Alaska environment, and then it became clear that it just costs more to live here. And in Kodiak, for example, I think the report cited that Kodiak's cost of living is about 28% higher. And I even think it's on Kodiak Island we're probably 10 to 12% higher than even in Anchorage. So what drives the cost of healthcare on Kodiak Island to a large extent is the cost of living, and then as a result of that, you know, our labor cost is a major portion of our healthcare expense, and so we have to compete. Locally, we have to compete in Alaska and nationally for some of the talent that we have here. And so when an employee, a pharmacist or a physical therapist, for example, nurse, comes to live on Kodiak, they're going to expect a living wage. And so you're going to have to be competitive with respect to the cost of living. And I've had some employees or candidates that looked at Kodiak elected not to come just because of the cost of living. So one of the things we do here is respond to that by trying to be in the market with our wages. And we also, uniquely to Kodiak, we pay a geographic wage differential, which means on top of the market, we pay a little extra in order to live on Kodiak Island. So that's to a large degree the reason I think that, and I can't speak for all rural Alaska, of course, but for Kodiak, that's unique to us, and I'm sure it's common across the state in a lot of rural areas as well.
And Don, when you talk about the difficulty of staffing a smaller hospital, what about the idea of having surgeons? We heard a little bit about needing not two full-time surgeons or specialty care providers, but maybe you need one and a half or one and a quarter. What do you find in that regard?
Gosh, that's a great comment that Jeff brought out, that Pat Branco in Ketchikan, because I start thinking, okay, what happens here is similar. In other words, in a small hospital, you have to have core staffing. And that means regardless of whether you have, patients here or not, you have to have, the staffing in place in order to respond in emergencies, for example. And a good example, and I'll maybe have relate a different one than Pat, which is similar, is we have 4,500 visits a year in the emergency room, which is not that, not that busy, but that averages out to be about 12 a day. And you would think, okay, one RN in the emergency room should surely be able to take care of 12 patients a day. But the problem is they don't come one at a time. So there are certain periods of the day and even at night where you may get 3, 4, 5 and even more patients responding to the emergency room. And with one RN, you can see clearly that you just can't safely take care of that many patients and provide the quality of care that you need to in that setting. So we've actually had to add another RN during certain hours of the day. And certainly there's times when there's a lot of downtime when these TORNs are probably not seeing any patients. But when it does get busy and there's a lot of patients that are responding to the ER, then of course they're there to take care of the patients. So that's just one more example, and we do have quite a few others. I do have two general surgeons here, and for a market this size, you probably would only need one and maybe a little more, but because of the need to have a general surgeon on the island at all times, you really do need two. Because there are traumas here, and there's a lot of life-saving requirements in the emergency room that requires general surgeon skill. And if we had a general surgeon leave on vacation and then someone came to the ER under a trauma situation, we just wouldn't be able to take care of them in a timely manner. So that's just another example, or similar to Pat's, where the cost of care is probably higher at times in rural areas because of the core staffing needs.
And Don, it sounds as if you're doing some interesting things there to try to bring down some costs. One of them, I understand, is sort of advanced telemedicine. Can you talk about that, what you're doing in that regard, and how that's impacted the need to medevac patients to Anchorage or other places?
Sure. Whenever there's new technology introduced, you always kind of wonder, okay, what's going to be the reception from the community and also the caregivers, the nurses and the physicians, for example. But we were actually a pilot study of a EICU out of Anchorage, out of PAMC, Providence. And what it is, it's just a telemedicine system where we can actually intensivists in Anchorage and nurses can actually manage and monitor a patient on Kodiak Island that's considered an intensive care patient, which is pretty remarkable. And so the result of that was the nurses just embraced this technology because they just love the support that's coming out of Anchorage, especially in the evenings and nights when physicians aren't available. They always have someone just a quick doorbell away, they call it. And the physicians like it because if they have a patient that they're not sure whether to transfer or not, they can also have the assistance of the intensivist. And when they're done for the day, they know that their patient is being properly monitored, managed throughout the night while they're at home resting. So as a result of this, there's been at least 17 and probably even more patients that have avoided the need to be transported to Anchorage for care on expensive medevac. So it's just part of, you know, keeping patients closer to home and reducing the overall cost of health care and the medevacs out. So it's been a great technology, very well received. In fact, we even purchased a second what we call cart, EICU cart, for our emergency room. So emergency room patients can even have, physicians can even have access to the technology and the intensivists from Anchorage. So it's been a great asset for us.
And beyond that sort of cooperation between hospitals and medical staff, do the hospitals coordinate on things such as we were talking about earlier, maybe people who travel around, sort of the circuit riding doctors or surgeons? Do you coordinate with other healthcare facilities about some of those kinds of things, or does it just not work that well?
Well, you know, I gave you the example of the general surgeons, and it would be really hard to do that. I suppose that you could. But then it's just a matter of, you know, if someone has to leave unexpectedly, how quickly can you get someone here? I guess the closest we come to coordination would be sharing specialists. You know, there are some specialists, of course, that Kodiak wouldn't be able to justify getting, for example, neurologists, allergists, ENT specialists. So instead of, you know, recruiting these higher-end specialists, we contract with these physicians out of Anchorage and elsewhere to come to Kodiak and have what they call specialty clinics. So that in effect, is a sharing of specialists. And that's on a scheduled basis and not on an emergency basis, but it sure does, you know, it utilizes the scarce resources in a more effective manner than just everybody having to go out and recruiting their own specialists. So in that respect, we do, to some degree, share in specialty care.
Well, Don, thank you so much for your time. I just have one more question before we let you go. Do you think that people in smaller communities, such as Kodiak, have different expectations for what their hospital should provide than in urban areas? Is it a different sentiment about what's going on at the hospital there than in larger cities?
You know, I guess that's a good question. I think the local community, just based on our satisfaction surveys and the response that we get from taking care of our patients, they're really proud of their local hospital and caregivers. And so, you know, the more that we can do effectively and cost-wise to provide quality and efficient care at the local level, I think it's very much appreciated. Having to travel off-island, we call it, to Anchorage or elsewhere for healthcare, is such a hardship on families and patients that if we can provide that care locally and even throughout the state on a local level, that's best for the patients and the families.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And
you're welcome.
Good luck out there.
Okay. Thank you.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide. 1-800-478-TALK or locally 550-8422 is the number in the Anchorage area. We're going to go to Steve now, who's in Wrangell and owns a small town pharmacy. Hi, Steve.
Well, hi.
So what's it like to own a small town pharmacy?
Yeah, my name's Steve Cole, and we own Stikine Drug here in Wrangell, Alaska. We've been here about 10 years, and we have poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into this pharmacy. And the only doctor clinic in town, they got a grant from Obama to open up their own pharmacy in July of 2010. And when doctors own pharmacies, it guts your business. Just yesterday, we got a letter from the clinic, and it states, "This letter is to inform you that Mr. Brown will not be getting his prescriptions filled at Stikine Drug. Effective immediately, please cancel all existing prescriptions and any refills that may be remaining." And then the doctor signed it. Mr. Brown wants to get his prescriptions filled at our drugstore. But the heavy-handedness of the medical clinic they insist that patients get prescriptions at their new pharmacy because they make money off that. And it's not really competition because they got a federal grant to open up their pharmacy, and they get to buy the drugs at VA contract prices. So that duplication of services costs money. And we have all the licenses that their pharmacy has, and it's, you know, a tough situation.
What's thank you for that call, Steve. What's known, Deb or Jeff, about this area of I know that the federal healthcare overhaul is very large and very complex, and it's coming in stages over the next several years. Do you know anything about this sort of particular situation where doctors are running pharmacies now? Is that unusual?
Well, I would imagine that this isn't a private physician clinic, but that it's a federally funded, grant-funded clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could imagine, I don't know what the exact situation in Wrangell is specifically, but I could imagine that there is and that that creates some tensions in a smaller community, an isolated community such as Wrangell, between federally supported health services and private providers.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things Mr. Rush referred to earlier that is one of the real challenges in Alaska is the lack of economies of scale, where you have to have some minimum infrastructure to support the healthcare needs of a particular community. And if you add to that infrastructure beyond the minimum need, but you still have the same number of people that you're essentially spreading that cost around, it's going to potentially drive up the costs for everybody. And the way competition works in healthcare just isn't quite the same as it works with TV and car sellers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it just really adds to the complexity
mm-hmm.
of managing those costs and figuring out the right way to do it.
Well, and I think Deb, your comments and Steve's story tells, illustrates the fact that healthcare is very strange animal. I mean, it's got moral and ethical implications and spiritual, but it also is a business at some level. And so trying to find the balance between what's ethical behavior and what's just prudent business behavior and what's best for the community, that is a big part of what makes this so complicated.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for the call. We're going to go to Richard in Anchorage now, who wants to talk about profits in the industry, I guess. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. Yeah, I've been listening, and I heard early in the show people talk about the cost associated with healthcare in the state and how that is driven up by salaries, cost of living, distance, sole providers, for example. But nobody's really talked about the profits that the physicians and the hospitals are making. I know in the rural areas it's different than in Anchorage and Fairbanks, but in Anchorage there's no sole providers. There's lots and lots of specialists here in almost every specialty. And the hospitals here make huge profits. For instance, the Providence system here is the cash cow of Providence in the Pacific Northwest, and a lot of the profits here go to fuel their other hospitals. And even though their costs are high, their profits remain pretty high.
And what do you know about those profits, Richard?
What do I know about them?
Right.
Well, I don't have them in front of me. I've only heard rumors about them, so I can't give you the numbers.
Okay.
But they've been in the tens of millions of dollars for many years. And I think we have no managed care in the state also, and that's been one of the factors other than the native system, which is a managed care system. We really have no managed care, and that's what's kept costs down and driven them down for both doctors and hospitals in other markets. And here we haven't seen that. And so just like some comment from your program people about that. And I just need one other comment. Somebody said that we could get costs from our doctors or hospitals and then see what our insurance companies will pay, and then go back and negotiate. And I know of nobody who can negotiate with hospitals or doctors because their insurance is going to pay less. I've never heard of that being successful anywhere unless you're an employer with lots of members in your insurance plan who can go negotiate. I don't think individuals have that power.
Well, thanks for the call, Richard. I would like to give out a little bit of information about profits. The nationwide average in 2010 was for hospitals was 6.3%. In Alaska, the urban hospitals do have a higher percentage. It's about 16.2%. And regional was actually the highest in 2010 at 29%. So they topped Providence in that regard. But his question about that, what's known about why those profits are different in Alaska than in other places? And, you know, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. I just realized we need to take a quick break.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about health care costs in Alaska, and we just kind of abruptly went to a break in the midst of a conversation about hospital profits here in Alaska. And what has the commission found in that regard, both about profits and the differences in what specialty care costs? And would it be helpful to release that publicly so that people can maybe use that as leverage? Richard sounded frustrated, saying, I don't think people can go to their doctor and get anywhere. So what's known about some of those numbers?
I have heard stories anecdotally, first to Richard's frustration, but about people being able to negotiate prices mm-hmm. with their provider. So I would still encourage them to do that, understanding that they don't have a lot of market power as individuals, and it takes a lot of time and energy to do that. What we do have documented in the Milliman reports is for physicians' services, the component, the healthcare actuarials conducting the study could not access easily like IRS forms, reports on individual physician practices, but had some other general information that they thought was indicative of the extent to which physicians specific and especially specialists in the state might be more indicative of a little bit more of a profit, and that was the level of discounts that are negotiated for physicians in Alaska by physicians with the payers, commercial payers, compared to the other states. And they found that the level of discounts was very, very low in Alaska compared to what physicians and payers would negotiate in other states. And they indicated that was an indication that there's physicians here have more pricing power, essentially.
Because they don't have as much competition.
Correct. Then for hospitals, what Milliman did was they actually broke down, looked at operating costs, the cost of the hospitals of operating. They did have more detailed information on the hospitals, publicly available information, and the operating margins. And found that for rural, thought that it was more helpful to break the hospitals up between rural and urban. And Don told some very good stories here a little bit ago from Kodiak about some of the particular challenges of small community hospitals. And Milliman found that the cost of operating hospitals in rural Alaska averaged together for the private sector, this was leaving out the federal facilities, was about 86% higher than the average of all operating costs of all of our comparison states.
Wow.
So averaging them all together. So they found that those special factors, transportation, fuel, oil, lack of economies of scale, all of those things really drove much higher costs for the hospitals to operate in those rural communities in Alaska. But then, as you were citing, found that there is a higher operating margin for the urban hospitals in Alaska, again, averaged together. And one of the things about this study, I'm a little hesitant to mention individual hospitals' measures because we weren't looking at comparing the facilities to each other. We were trying to get a sense of the overall private hospital sector and the private physician service sector. And you can get into trouble when you start taking this information and applying it to individual financial analyses. But it is true that overall the profit margins, the operating profit margins specifically for urban hospitals averaged together in Alaska are significantly higher than in other states. And I think, again, that is pricing power, supply and demand.
And
I would imagine is what's partly driving that.
Can some of that come back around to this idea of usual and customary? If it costs so much more in rural Alaska to provide services, does that get factored into some of the costs statewide? We had an email, Jeffrey, from someone in Anchorage here that wanted to know the UCR rates that your Blue Cross Blue Shield uses. And her question, Lisa's question, was fairhealth.org, which also provides a UCR database and is used by a number of other insurers. She wanted to know, is the data in their rates the same as yours? And if not, why not? She said, it seems as if usual and customary prevailing rate in a community is going to be the same no matter which insurer you have. So what's the reality there of kind of mashing all these costs around the state together to come out with the usual and customary?
Very good question, Lisa. I just mentioned you had asked earlier if how the commission study could be publicly available, and it's available on the commission's website. So if someone's interested in finding it, they can go out there and they can find the Milliman report as well as the commission's report. But to Lisa's question, the data is not the same. We use our data, and then Fair Health would use the data from a collection of other insurers. The state regulation around the development of UCR is fairly specific, but broad enough that there's variation in the way that actuaries would use the numbers to come up with it. And then finally, I think the fact that we break the state into four regions is different than what Fair Health does. So we're trying to be more microscopic about the cost in a particular region. You know, we don't have the same UCR in Fairbanks as we do in Anchorage. The Fairbanks is based on Fairbanks, and the Anchorage is based on Anchorage. So there are methodological differences.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I can't believe it. The hour is over. We didn't get to a lot of great calls, but we did get to many great calls. Thank you so much to Deb Erickson and Jeffrey Davis. Annie Feit was on phones. Dave Waldron on engineering. Josh Edge. I'm Lori Townsend. And join us next week.
Made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Atwood Foundation and Alaska Children's Trust. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.